Welcome, everyone, to our third session with Professor Elaine France from Kent State University. Today's topic is the strike of 1877. She and I were talking earlier about how we did not study this in school, not even in college. And how many people in the room knew about this big strike? One. Okay, good for you. So we've got a lot to learn today, and I'll turn it over to Elaine.
Ago, I remember that the anniversary of the strike of 1877 was coming up, which began something else. I don't think I would have been able to say there was a strike of 1877. I just not turn this on.
I totally not did not turn on, but now it's on. Okay. Yeah. You just need to gesture at me, Ted, because I always forget. So I'll start again. So a couple years ago, I realized that the anniversary, the 150th anniversary of the strike of 1877 was coming up, which had come to mean something to me because I'd started to be more attuned to labor history in the last several years. And so I was like, oh yeah, 1877. But I realized I probably don't think the strike of 1877, I could have named it or it meant anything to me even 10 years ago, even though I'm a professional historian working on this period. I didn't think about it at all, right? And then I started being more attuned to labor history, and I realized this had been a really big deal that we didn't really talk about, like so much of labor history we don't talk about in our history education, right? As I realized that we're coming up to the 150th, historians are doing a whole bunch of things now to commemorate to commemorate the strike of 1877. And I'm actually editing a volume of a academic journal, scholarly journal, which is all about 1877. So I'm starting to think a lot more about the strike of 1877. And that's where I got the idea for this whole subject, for this series, this February series. So I'm looking forward to talking about the actual strike today. And then also, I mean, one thing we're talking about a lot in my survey is why has nobody commemorated the strike of 1877? Like, why is it so absent in our textbooks? And so I think that's actually something we ought to think about as well. That wasn't as dramatic as I was hoping. Let's see. Huh. Yeah. We tried it and it worked. But no, it is not. Okay. There we go. Okay. So basically, what we're going to be talking about today is what happened in July of 1877. And that was Pittsburgh workers and community members rose up in 1877 to demand better pay as part of a nationwide strike, but Pittsburgh was at the very center of it. The state stepped in and violently ended the strike with at least 22 deaths in Pittsburgh in a single day. And so the question is, I want to come around at the end here to how did the church respond to this in Pittsburgh? Nobody's studied it. So this was just me, you know, looking through newspapers and trying to figure out how the churches in Pittsburgh responded to the strike and finding a couple of examples and extrapolating from there.
Did you get into the strikers achieve some progress?
I will.
Okay.
I will. Yeah. Oh, there's so much to say. Okay, but basically, this is a quotation in the bold is a quotation from a book about the strikes called 1877, and it says Pittsburgh was where workers would fight the hardest and where state brutality would be the most marked. So I wanted to start with that. And this image, to be totally honest with you, I couldn't find. I chose this image. Most of the images I'm gonna have today are of Pittsburgh. They actually, one thing that's actually really important about this strike is that we have a lot of new technologies to record the violence of the strikes. And in particular, we have stereographs. Stereograph technology is going to be actually very important here. But this isn't a stereograph, it's an engraving. But this engraving is actually not of the strike in Pittsburgh. This engraving is of the strike in Martinsburg, West Virginia, where it first started. So, are you from Martinsburg?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's where it started. That's where this whole national strike started in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Okay, so basically, here's how it went down. The Pennsylvania Railroad June of 1877 reduced all wages for so if there's a there's a recession. We mentioned this before. I mentioned this before. Starting in 1873, all the wartime prosperity sort of collapses. It's complicated, but there's some problems with stock trading and whatnot, and particularly the railroads are at the center of it, and it leads to a big collapse, economic collapse. So there's a big, ugly recession starting in 1873, high unemployment, municipalities don't have enough money to pay workers, right? All sorts of things. So in June of 1877, all of the railroads, or the Pennsylvania Railroad, following the lead of other railroads, including the B&O, which is what was in Martinsburg, it reduces the wages for its employees by 10%. This is the third round of wage decreases that the employees have faced. So their wages are down. I wish I could tell you exactly, let's say a third. They're basically asking people to work the same job for two-thirds of what they had been working for the year prior, right? And they know they'll have to do it because the economy is so bad they can't get other work, right? And what they're saying is, we, the railroads, are having economic problems, and so we have to. And at the same time, they say that freight trains between Pittsburgh and some other locations are going to be double headers. And what that means is they're going to add twice as many cars to each train. So you're going to have half as many employees working on the cargo trains. So it's going to lead to massive layoffs as well as the wage cuts. And so in response to this, So in response to this, there's really not any railroad unions yet. Okay, there are some unionization is a thing that exists. And particularly in Europe, there's a lot of labor radicalism and there's a big socialist movement in Europe, right? That in Europe, a lot of workers' groups are beginning to have a lot of political power, right? But this hasn't happened in the United States. And partially it hasn't happened because there was an idea in the United States, which really was a reality, that companies are so small, firms are so small, that people work out things with human interaction rather than having to go to the lengths of formal things like strikes, right? So there's this idea that in a small company, people are moving up the ladder, right? And they know each other personally, and that binds them together morally. Like the owners will act in a certain way because they know the workers, and the workers are the future of the company and whatnot. So for various reasons, even though there's been a rise of communism, right? Socialism, right? And all sorts of, including unionization, right? In Europe, in many parts of Europe, and a lot of labor violence in England and Germany, certainly in France, where there was the workers took over France in 1871 in a revolution called the Paris Commune. Even though all of these things had happened, In the United States, it was notable that there was very little labor violence. There were occasional strikes that happened even before the Civil War, but they were much less violent and contentious. Okay, I don't want to underplay that. Sometimes they got violent. Okay, so basically what happens is in Martinsburg, West Virginia, which is a crucial choke point for the railroads going out of Baltimore, the especially the powerful B&O Railroad, the workers of Martinsburg said they would refuse to let the trains run. That not only would they go on strike, but they would block the trains from running through the B&O network until they got paid better. And I'm just going to say what's just happened, we don't think about it like this, but what has just happened in the South was a whole bunch of people owned a lot of property, and that property was slaves. And then the government said, you do own this property, but it's not moral. So we're going to not consider it property anymore. This property relationship was immoral, and therefore we're going to take your property away because of our laws, right? So now it's, you know, less than 20 years later, and the workers are kind of saying, yes, the owners of the railroads own this property, but we no longer have these personal relationships that make it moral. And so we need the government to step in to basically, we need to have a system, right, to step in to say they're not allowed to treat us like this. It's illegal for them to use their property in the way that they want to if it involves our getting paid so little. Okay, so that's the logic of what they're saying. Okay, so it starts in Martinsburg, and you have railroad workers strike over wage cuts, and also in Martinsburg, doubleheaders. You have the local militia comes out to try to suppress it. But you actually have the workers of Martinsville take over the city for a brief time, right? They're all going to lose ultimately. But that begins, then that idea of what's happened up in Martinsburg, and they stop all the railroads from running. Baltimore just stops sending out cars because they can't get anywhere. Okay. And here I just want to show you an important building to this story, which is if you go to the Strip District, right? So this is going to be the Pennsylvania Railroad station, okay? And it's on Penn at 28th. And this is going to be the heart of where the strike is going to be once it reached Pittsburgh. So as soon as the strike starts in West Virginia, it starts to spread. It spreads to Baltimore. It spreads to St. Louis. It's going to ultimately spread all over the country, even to the West Coast. It's going to be massive. More than 100,000 people are going to go on strike. And I think that's actually an underestimate. Nobody's really counted. So it's going to be really huge. And all trains are basically stopped throughout the entire country. Yes. It made the economy worse. That's right. It freezes the economy. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a national crisis. There's nobody can get, everybody depends on trains, right? The mail can't get anywhere. You know, nothing can get anywhere. People can't get anywhere, right? It's like, if you think about trains at this time are planes, you know, they're everything, right? There's no highway, right? So they're the form of transportation other than maybe like boats, right? Okay, so sympathetic. Most newspapers in Pittsburgh are going to be on the side of the railroad companies. Okay, that's going to be true of almost all the newspapers. So it's hard to get the voice of what the workers thought they were doing during this, because the newspapers are all going to be pro-railroad company, except for this one newspaper, which was a workers' newspaper, which was a weekly newspaper, this one right here, called the National Labor Tribune out of Pittsburgh. And it says, this is the voice of the workers. It says, these men merely want to live and do not want their wives and little ones to starve, which they must certainly do if they're compelled to accept the terms of the company and go to work. Okay, so basically what happens here is a the train workers of Pittsburgh, like in many other places, organize and quickly form a union almost immediately called the Train Man's Union. And this is actually a picture drawing of a man named J.A. Amon, who is a brakeman. He's a regular train worker. And he becomes the head of this union very quickly. And he runs this strike in Pittsburgh. The newspapers immediately start calling him Boss Amon, and are very, saying he's like bringing radicalism, to the workers. Okay, so their plan is they're not going to destroy any railroad property, but they're going to protect it. They put like sentinels around the railroad property. They're going to protect the railroad property, but they're going to refuse to allow it to run until the owners give in to their demands for restoring their wages. So on July 19th, the strike begins in Pittsburgh. I'm going to give just a second of background here about what had happened the previous week in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh didn't have enough money to pay its police, unfortunately for them. And so a week earlier, they had laid off half of their police force. Okay. Sent them home. And in fact, they couldn't even bear to tell them. So they just listed, they couldn't decide who to lay off. So they just listed in the newspaper and they said, wake up in the morning, the police can look at this newspaper. If your name's on here, you're still on the force. So you could actually, so half the force comes back and the other half is laid off now. And so now we have this big strike emerging. So the owners go to this guy, our mayor, William Roaring Bill McCarthy, who you will not be surprised to hear is very pro-labor, right? Like many of our mayors, he comes from a labor background himself. He is not sympathetic to the call to suppress the strike. So the owners say, well, send the police. We just need 10 police, and you need to come with them and tell the strikers to cut it out. He won't go. And he also says, oh, we're really short on police right now because you guys made us, they made us lay off half our police. But you could hire some of the police that have been laid off if you want. Here's their names. They need some money. Some of those police are rehired by the railroad, but they're paid by the railroad, but they're now police again. And they do go out as though to suppress the strike. Now, how enthusiastic are they about suppressing the strike? They are not enthusiastic about suppressing the strike. So they go and like lounge around with the strikers, right? And basically are paid but refuse to suppress the strike. Okay, and then they call out, they go to the sheriff, Sheriff Fife, and there's like, you need to call out a posse. You need to, call out a posse to suppress the strike, which he has the right to do. And he does. He issues an order mobilizing the people of Pittsburgh to suppress the strike. And people don't come. People don't show up. He ends up with like a tiny, tiny posse. And they can't do anything. And so he kind of shows up and he yells at them, like, you guys need to stop. And then he like leaves. He doesn't do anything. And then both he and the mayor are like detained out of town. They both just get out of the way. They both like leave, right? They're like, and cannot be reached for the rest of the strike, right? They just get out of there. The Fife is like, my wife is sick in Castle Shannon. So like, he's just somewhere in Castle Shannon. We don't know where, but, okay. You can't see that. I'm sorry, that visual doesn't really work. You'll see the other visuals better. But basically what happens is then they call out the militia. So there's a Pittsburgh militia. In every city, there's a militia which does drill every year, a lot of Civil War veterans. And those people mobilize. But unfortunately for the owners, those people also are sympathetic with the mob, which is growing and growing over this time until you have thousands of people in the street of the Strip District around this train station. And the soldiers fraternize, and this is a quote from the time, soldiers frater, this is a quote from a government report later. Soldiers fraternized with the mob. Most of the time, the arms, their weapons were stacked, and they were mingled indiscriminately with the crowd. They were lying about on the ground talking with them. Okay, so the militia doesn't do any good because everybody's like, you know what, these guys have a point. So they have a problem. So what do they do? Oh, I want to say a little bit more about who's in the mob. And here, this is fresh scholarship that nobody knows but us now, because it's going to come out in this journal soon. But it's a quote. There's a woman named Rosemary Foyer who talked about the role of women in these strikes. And she's talking nationally, but she also focuses a lot on Pittsburgh. She says, "Women in Pittsburgh joined crowds protecting workers who uncoupled trains and shut down lines, demonstrating broad community opposition to the Pennsylvania Railroad Company. Women blocked the tracks in large numbers. When the sheriff read a proclamation ordering them to move, they shouted a resounding no. Commanders later claimed that the crowds used women and children as shields and instruments. When the regiment commander warned the crowd someone would be hurt, he says, the women answered me that, quote, they were there to urge the men to do what they wanted." Employers feared the spread of communism, particularly through organizations like the Working Men's Party, which had recently been founded in places like St. Louis and Chicago that didn't exist yet, and Pittsburgh. And so they're really getting anxious about these crowds. So what's going to happen is on July 20th, when none of these other means of suppressing the strike work, they call out the they call they basically. Get in touch with the president, with Hayes, and they call out the Philadelphia militia. With his support, they call it the Philadelphia militia from the 1st Philadelphia National Guard, and 600 militiamen from Philadelphia get on trains, which they could still run across the state to Pittsburgh, and they head to Pittsburgh. Okay. When they arrive on the 21st, and this is back to Rosemary Foyer. She says, women led the hissing when the 600 Philadelphia soldiers arrive. They have with them two Gatling guns, so two of these kind of newfangled machine guns, right? As the crowd surrounded the troops and blocked police, the police, who in fact were at this point attempting to arrest a few of the strike leaders, some of these new police or restored police, the militiamen bayoneted several people who were trying to keep them from being suppressed, right? Militiamen bayoneted several people, probably not fatally. The crowd responded to the soldiers with taunts and projectiles, and then the soldiers opened fire. They killed 22 and they wounded many more. Among other things, they actually shot a baby whose mother was breastfeeding her on the porch of her home. The colonel of the militia later testified that at least half of the crowd that was gathered were women and children. And these were women and children. It wasn't just the striking workers. Well, anybody who wanted to support them had come out with them, including their families and other people. And he said, and these, without warning, were fired into, and many of them killed or wounded. Of course, this caused, and this is Colonel David Smith is the one testifying here, and he's a colonel from the Pittsburgh militia. And so he's watching this because they were there, but they weren't the ones shooting. He said, half the crowd was women and children, and these, without warning, were fired into, and many of them killed or wounded. Of course, this caused universal indignation and condemnation, and was the occasion of all the subsequent troubles and destruction. Okay, so they shot into this crowd, killing men, women, and children. And we don't have good lists of who was killed. We know from the time that it was about 22 people. at least 22 people. I think it was probably more, but because of the chaotic nature of the government at that moment, they actually never collected really good lists. Okay. And this is, again, focusing on women, but you can get a sense from what the women are doing, what everybody else is doing. This is from Rosemary Foyer's article. Enraged citizens trapped the Philadelphia militia after shooting withdraws into a railroad building. It withdraws into a building called a roundhouse. And the Pittsburgh Regiment members continue to not do anything. They continue to sit around and not be involved. Women took the lead in blackguarding the surrounding troops. So women are yelling at them and insulting the surrounding troops. Witnesses described their language as filled with viler epithets than the men present and the most outrageous language I have ever heard in my life. They've just killed 22 people, right? One commander testified that it contributed to desertions. A lot of the members of the militia deserted at that point, the Philadelphia militia. He says, quote, "They were a little worse than the men. The language was terrible." In retaliation for the murders, crowds then began to burn railroad property, including lots of freight cars. Women brought tea and coffee to men destroying the cars, and then they joined the effort to disperse goods. She's being very sympathetic here. They looted, all of the areas, around, the companies and the areas of railroad property, but also other property around. They began breaking into shops and started to seize guns and ammunition, which they used to fire on the militiamen. After the troops began a hasty retreat, looting and burning broke out through the city of Pittsburgh. They participated with young boys and girls, and women participated with young boys and girls in carrying off commodities and foodstuffs. Colonel Smith testified that most goods were carried away, quote, by girls about 16 years of age and by boys up to 20 years of age. Okay, so I'll just give you a couple of images here. And these are just images from the strike, which unfortunately you can't see very well, so I apologize. This is an image of workers fighting with the militia. This image is also not from Pittsburgh. I couldn't find a really good one like this from Pittsburgh. This is from Baltimore. But this is happening all over the country where there's a railroad depot, but Pittsburgh is the most violent. In St. Louis, the workers actually take over the city for a few days, and all the government leaves St. Louis in charge of the workers. They establish a government. They call it the St. Louis Commune. Okay. Incidentally, the people who set up the St. Louis Commune, they don't end up ever like being punished. And in fact, they go on to be part of St. Louis government in years going forward, right? So it's like, it's a really interesting kind of near revolution, right? In which people are kind of folded back into society afterwards. Okay, so basically, this is a scene from when the soldiers have retreated to the roundhouse. The workers set a car on fire. It's full of coal. They set it on fire, and then they all push it towards the roundhouse to set the roundhouse on fire so that, the soldiers would have to flee the roundhouse, right? That actually doesn't work. The soldiers have water in the roundhouse and they spend a night in the roundhouse being attacked constantly. And they manage to douse the flames while they're still in there. Though ultimately the roundhouse does burn down. This is an image of that. And this is also, you can't see this as well as I would have hoped, but people are really freaked out about women being so active in this strike, but that's true of all places, not just Pittsburgh. And they start talking about the women as Petrolouses, which is what the French women were called who were involved in 1871. And the Petrolouses, these kind of women were both celebrated and condemned in popular culture as sort of like Marianne, sort of like, spirits of freedom, leading the charge bravely, but also, and that's a Marianne image, but then also as sort of, haggard, anti-women. The Petroluses were particularly known for arson, for causing, because they were the petrol, they burned down buildings in order to bring down the forces of capital, right? And so people start calling the Pittsburgh women Petroluses, and it's a big deal. Let's see. Okay, so as a result of all this, what's ultimately going to happen? Well, maybe I'll talk first about what happens to the militia, because when last we spoke, they were hiding in the roundhouse, being attacked by a group trying to burn them down. And actually, the people got a cannon. The workers got a cannon, and one of the reasons the soldiers ultimately had to leave the roundhouse is that the workers had positioned a cannon so that it could shoot the roundhouse. So the workers actually leave the roundhouse, or the soldiers leave the roundhouse. And they go out on Penn and they march out of the city towards the arsenal where they're going to take shelter at the arsenal. And as they're marching out of the city, people are shooting at them from second story windows. I think I have a good quote about that. Thought I had a good quote about that. Shoot. Oh, here we go. No. Okay, well, I'm missing my quote, but let's say women and men are shooting from second story windows down at the troops as they move through Lawrenceville to the arsenal. People are jumping out from like a street corners and shooting at them. And my favorite moment was they go by a police station, which at that point is on Penn. There's 10 policemen lined up at that police station. And they said 8 to 10. And one of them says to the soldiers who are marching by, "Where are you going?" And one of the soldiers says, "We don't know. We're just like, we're just following where they tell us." And the one of the policemen says, "You're damn right, you don't know. You're going to hell." And he pulls out a gun. And from the front of the police station, he shoots at these soldiers it becomes an issue, right? But he shoots at these soldiers who are marching by. They actually don't stop because if you're a soldier, you don't break formation as you're retreating from a dangerous situation, right? That would have been the death of them, right? So they stay in formation, they keep on marching. He doesn't kill anyone, he doesn't hit anyone. And afterwards, the commander goes back to the mayor and is like, "You have to figure out what this was. Like, this is unacceptable." And the mayor goes to the police station. And he's like, "Okay, you're gonna have to turn in who did this?" And what did the police say? "Nothing happened. What are you talking about?" They totally denied that anything happened at all, right? But anyway, so the soldiers, they march out and they're gonna take shelter at the arsenal, but then like the commander of the arsenal is like, "You guys can't come in here. It's not safe for us." So won't let the soldiers into the arsenal except for wounded soldiers. One of the soldiers is actually killed during this retreat, and he's allowed, his body is allowed in the arsenal, and a couple of wounded soldiers are allowed in as well. And the other soldiers have to go somewhere nearby and camp out. And then ultimately they, find a way to get back to Pittsburgh, or to get back to Philly without any more drama. Order is restored in Pittsburgh by calling up a huge, a bunch of men form a new militia, basically propertied men, and they patrol the city and ultimately restore order in Pittsburgh. And similarly, throughout the country, ultimately these strikes are suppressed. So here's the ruins of the depot. Here's the roundhouse, the railroad roundhouse, the ruins of the roundhouse. This is part of a stereograph, but you could see here some of the trains that the uprising destroyed. And this is all Strip District pictures. Here's a bunch of people like the next day standing around the trains. Altogether, the mob. Altogether, the mob destroyed 1,600 railroad cars and 126 locomotives. They burned 16 buildings, a grain elevator, several machine shops, the roundhouse, the Union Depot. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to just talk about, and this is going to be very brief because, again, we don't know that much about it, but what do churches do? Right, like, so this has happened, and you have to like go to church, and like these ministers are like, oh, somebody may want me to say something about this, right? So a couple of things I picked up, and this is going to be dribs and drabs. I want to apologize for it, but this is what we know about the context. We know that at this moment there's a religious revival running in Castle Shannon, where there often was religious revivals. That was a camp meeting ground in Castle Shannon. You'd pick up the train at Carson Street and you'd take it out to Castle Shannon for a camp meeting revival. Maybe you'd even camp out there. Okay, so there's a religious revival that would have been a Methodist revival that's running at this point at Castle Shannon. So I always just like the fact that that very day of these strikes are happening, people are headed over to Carson and headed over to this revival, right? But you actually, one of these quotes up here is like, I don't know about our revival. This might cause us some problems, right? We know that in response to this, one thing that happens is that temperance groups get really supercharged. Remember, this is just this all is what, 3 years after the Women's Christian Temperance Crusade. And so one thing they say is, if the workers weren't drinking, right, maybe this wouldn't have happened. Their family would have plenty of money and they wouldn't have had to protest, right? So the temperance groups get really supercharged. On July 31st, there's a movement at the County Christian Temperance Alliance. There's a motion that instead of talking about temperance, they should try to talk about how to make all labor illegal on Sundays. They're trying to say, what can we do here in this temperance movement to try to help out the plight of workers and kind of, lower the temperature on some of these things. So people are coming up with these creative solutions. I have a lot of quotes here from Pittsburgh ministers. They cover the sermons in the newspapers. And so we have here the Pan-Presbyterian Council is actually meeting at this point. The International Presbyterian Council is meeting in Edinburgh at this point. And so this probably was not specifically responding to, but this is at the very moment of the strikes. And they're saying, the simple preaching of the Bible is the true work of the ministry. And I included that because, one thing that people are going to say is, look, churches should respond perhaps, but also we have to remember this is about the Bible, right? And I think that's what's kind of being underlined by the Pan-Presbyterian Council here. We have here the Bishop Kerfoot promulgated for the Episcopal Church a most appropriate form of prayer to be used in Pittsburgh in reference to the present disturbed condition of society. So the Episcopalians come up with a new kind of prayer, and we can't know what it is, that's going to be used to help people think through what's happening with the labor unrest. Reverend Pearson, he preaches the crisis and Christians' duty at the Baptist Church. And then they give each minister a little blurb space. And so he adds this editorial comment, right? He says, isn't this the time for the ministry to speak? If there is influence in the pulpit that could be used towards calming agitation, it surely ought to be used now. Now, when he says calming agitation, what is he talking about? Right? He's talking about calming the workers, right? We have Reverend Snyder. He got back from his vacation, and he will occupy his pulpit at the East End. He says, it is feared that the present unsettled state of affairs may seriously interfere with the camp meetings that we have coming up, because this is a, you know, time of a lot of camp meetings. And then we have Reverend Vernon, the Methodist Episcopalian Church, who's going to preach on the riot, its causes and lessons. Okay, so ministers respond in different ways, but in general, the response of the churches seems to be, we have to get involved, but we have to get involved in calming the workers. And calming the workers may involve making some concessions, right? But in general, what they want to do is figure out, how do we make the workers less inclined to be violent, right? Or strikey. And so here we have Henry Ward Beecher, the most powerful minister. We've talked about him before. He's the most famous minister at this time. He's in New York City. He's known for being extremely wealthy, and he's also just come through a terrible sex scandal. He had an affair with his main assistant, Theodore Tilton, his wife. He had an affair with Mrs. Tilton. So he's kind of disgraced, but he kind of apologized. He's like, man, you know, sin, it's the worst, you know. So he like had his like big apology, and he's kind of back in the newspapers, and he's trying to rehabilitate himself, but he's lost a lot of power. But he comes back now, and he has his sermon in response to this is, water costs nothing. Men cannot live by bread, but they can live on bread and water. A man who cannot live on bread and water is not fit to live. When a man is educated away from the power of self-denial, he's falsely educated. A family may live on good bread and water in the morning, bread at midday, good bread and water at night. Such may be called the bread of affliction, but it is fit that men should eat the bread of affliction. So he comes out like kind of staunchly pro-capital, right, in this conflict. And he gets a lot of blowback, and he's actually out there then like the next week, like, that's not, you guys are totally misreading what I was saying, right? You know, he's totally out there, like, you know, dialing back the sermon. But basically, so the churches are trying to figure out, how do we deal with this? And what I want to leave you with is next week, because what this actually is going to do is it's going to start the social gospel movement. It's going to start at this moment. The social gospel movement is a period when Protestant churches are going to focus very heavily on social work. Things like building institutional churches with kitchens and, you know, helping the homeless and having AA meetings, you know, in your church, right? Things like that are the kind of, though not specifically, AA is going to come a little later, but you know, having a basketball court in your church, maybe, right? Things like that are going to, or a bowling alley, things like that are going to be coming out of this crisis as the church tries to work about how do we, or like more focus on the YMCA, like funding the YMCA, right? Things like that are going to come out of how do we work with the poor, right? Or with workers. And that's it. Yes.
How was the strike? Did they get any concessions?
They didn't get concessions, no. But I mean, they just were in a very weak position because the economy was so bad. So they didn't really get concessions. Most people think, however, that this ended up in a longer term, like even within the next few years. The railroad companies realize that they can't have this happen again. And so they do end up, over the next few years, solving a lot of the problems that were upsetting the workers, including increasing wages and things like that. So I kind of, the take that I'm getting right now from my economic historian, my business historian who's writing for my issue, kind of talks a lot about this, that they don't get concessions to the strike, but they do get a long-term increase over the next few years, and they also just radically reorganize the railroad leadership. Like basically everybody who's running the railroads at this time gets cut. Right, and gets replaced by new management who have different ideas about employee relations. So he actually, the business historian who's kind of contributing to this issue is actually, he's talking about how what really happened with the strike was really, really ineffective railroad management. Like they could have afforded, they could have afforded to deal with this, right, in a better way. And but the railroads had increased so dramatically that the men who were running them didn't have the tools to manage such large entities and were making a lot of sort of self goals. And so what he says is that this actually sort of forced the railroad management to become better organized and get better at employee relations. They're also going to form more permanent unions, which are going to be able to advocate for their rights in the coming years. Yes. Why was it so much worse in Pittsburgh than in other places? That's a really good question. Pittsburgh is really a worker city, and it's run by workers. Like the mayor, the sheriff, the everybody they really believed, I think that they had a lot more hope that this strike would succeed in Pittsburgh. So they're going to put more all in. I think that's part of what happened. And I think because they couldn't find anyone internal to Pittsburgh to suppress the strike, like in Philly, the Philly militia suppressed the strike in Philly, then came to suppress the strike in Pittsburgh. In Pittsburgh, support for workers was so great that they had to bring somebody from outside to suppress it. And I think that maybe that made a big difference in how, that the fact that they're willing to shoot, that they were coming from elsewhere. So that's another theory. Also, Pittsburgh is going to be a place where the forces of the concentration of capital are the greatest. So Pittsburgh is actually like a really unique place in the history of industrialization, in that we're a center of industrialization. And so maybe it's kind of the white hot center of this whole process of the concentration of wealth that's going on at this moment.
I think you spoke last week about communism and socialism and how that was, we're almost at a tipping point. Was that before this, or did this fan that flame as well? And what really caused the nation to go towards capitalism versus socialism or communism?
There's so much written about that. The International Socialist Party actually moved to New York City in, I can't give you the year, but I want to say it's like 1869. So it was, there really was, and there's so much to talk about, but like Pittsburgh had huge socialist and communist parties, right, marching the streets of Pittsburgh from this time up through the 1930s, right, up through the Depression era. There were massive communist and socialist parties, running for office, marching through the streets, especially around here and in Ohio. It was really kind of a center for both socialism and communism, and the IWW, which is going to emerge as kind of the labor union that has that position. So no, I can't tell you why Capital One. That's like the core. If I could answer that, I wouldn't have time. I'd be like, I don't know where I'd be, but nobody can answer that, right? Because the historians work to answer that. But I think, I mean, the real interesting fact to people at the time was that President Hayes chose to allow the sending of the militia of the National Guard. He was kind of the crucial figure. If he had said, no, we won't send them, everything would have been very different. The other fact is, why are there so much National Guard? Why is there so much military? And in our case, it was the National Guard. But why is there so much military available to be deployed? It's because we had just ended Reconstruction. So all the soldiers have been called back from Reconstruction. And now we're available to be deployed. But Hayes actually says, we have some of his, his correspondence from this period. He said, I don't think we have enough soldiers. I don't think we can suppress this. So we actually have him saying, like, I hope this stops, because if I keep on getting these requests for soldiers, we're pretty much running out. I will also say, because I feel like I need to say it, but over in the West, like in California, the 1877 labor strikes largely end up being massacres of Chinese people, right? Chinese workers who are competing for, so there's all it gets really complicated, like how it's going down everywhere. Yeah, and the 1877 strikes often were sort of racist, in that black people, particularly freed people, tended to be available as strike breakers, right? So there was, so there's all this kind of, it all ties in then with like the end of Reconstruction and the flow of new workers, up from the South. And it's, yeah, so I can't really tell you. Most labor historians say, when they say, why was there no socialism in the United States? Or like, why didn't we get more? Like they did in Europe, why didn't the workers get more? Often they'd say it's because there was such a heterogeneous mix of workers. A lot of workers didn't speak the same language. In Chicago, like the German women in Chicago were like known for being extra aggressive, but like people are separated by their ethnicity and can't even necessarily talk to each other. You have people speaking multiple languages, and then you also have a racial divide, or two racial divides if you go out west. So that weakened the workers. So maybe that's it. And that's 1877.
Thank you.